Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the Benny to my Lenny and the Asbury Duke to my Amboy Duke, it's Dan.
Good morning, Scott. You enjoying, ready for another installment of our special Legionnaire's Disease podcast?
I do feel somewhat infected with the fever that the show has given me from a week-to-week basis. So, yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
I'm totally ready. I mean, hopefully we'll have another in-depth discussion covering this latest chapter. Every time we think they've hit a certain benchmark of wow at the show, they seem to find a new way to top themselves, which how often do you come across a TV series that does that? Not too often.
Yeah. No, very rarely. And also, I took a double dose of Clobetasin medicine this week, so I might be sleeping by the end of this podcast again.
Okay.
Just kidding, I didn't.
All right, but maybe you should mix some Red Bull into that or something. So let's before we break the seal on Chapter 5, and Lord knows there's going to be a lot to say about that, let's give one more look back at Chapter 4 with some more thoughts on last week's episode. Now, I don't actually have quite as much about last week's episode as I normally do. Not because last week's episode wasn't chock full of stuff. I just actually think we covered a lot in our initial podcast. So, upon a second viewing, it tended to be, you know, little lines of dialogue that kind of stuck out or little moments that I might have neglected to mention or we just neglected to talk about. First of all, once again, right from the get-go, we get into the question of what is real or not, and you realize that while before, when we talked about the mission that they went on, it was about tracking down things from David's past and whatever, but the fact that Sid very succinctly says, what was real, that was the mission, is actually a nice, really crisp line. It really tells you everything about that episode, and even the show itself, because maybe that's what our mission is, really, to figure out what is real on this show. And we also get another great line early on where she says, who are we if not the stories we tell ourselves? Which I think really speaks to David's character more than anyone else about how either he has convinced himself of certain things over the years or other forces have, which obviously is explored in this episode and also touched on in the episode we're going to talk about a little bit later. And continuing the theme of wondering what is real or what is not, the fact that you would have another separate character, in this case Dr. Kissinger himself, literally out loud trying to reaffirm his own existence. He's actually, you know, yelling out that I exist, and he's insisting on it. That's interesting. It's like having characters who want you to know, like, no, I really am real. I'm not just a figment of someone else's imagination. And I think they are trying to do that with the Dr. Kissinger character.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And compelling, because who knows what they could do with that kind of thing down the line.
Yeah, and it does become just that much more of a mind warp the more we've gone on in this series. It's interesting that I feel that we're tending to question things more than less from episode to episode, especially after Chapter 5. But back to Chapter 4, another interesting line, and I think it's Oliver who says this. There's a lot of interesting stuff with Oliver in that episode. When I think I believe he says something along the lines of, what's real in this space is whatever you want it to be. That's when you start to realize that this, what we're seeing as far as that astral plane, as far as that floating ice cube, as far as even the very decor in that home, this is all what Oliver himself has created. And he's relaying this information to David. And as we do, as I believe we do find out in the following chapter, which informs the previous one, David has this ability as well. There is something I was curious about. It's very clear that Oliver is waiting for something or someone. but it's never clear what it is he's waiting for. Because he doesn't talk like someone who's waiting to be rescued or freed from the astral plane. So if it's not that, I wonder, what is it he's waiting for?
I wonder if he has his like own version of the yellow-eyed devil, and like that he's just kind of like freaked out and like waiting for that to happen.
Right. You know, by the way, speaking, I'm going to skip ahead a few right now, since you mentioned him. I think at this point, we should go with what you said in our very last podcast. Because you, if I'm not mistaken, one of the things you did actually get a chance to say was you were thinking that it was a very distinct possibility that that creature, the devil with the yellow eyes, was possibly, in fact, a character from the comic books known as the Shadow King. I do remember you saying that.
Right.
I'm of a mind to believe you and believe that to be true. And that, at the very least, to be the inspiration, if not a phrase or a name we're going to specifically hear at some point in this series. But I actually did my own little bit of research after what you had said, and when I saw the pictures of the character, I was like, oh, that's got to be what this is. And reading about him more, I was like, okay, I think we should refer to that character as the Shadow King from this point on. It's also a lot easier to say than the devil with the yellow eyes or anything.
Yeah. I'm sure you heard me fumbling trying to figure out what the hell I was going to call it there. It's like, I know it's better than whatever they had on season one of True Detective, but I can't quite... verbalize it.
Oh, what was that? The Yellow King or Mustard King?
Something like that. I don't know.
Sun King. I'm throwing out all Beatle references now, I think. But I like...
That's actually good.
If we could actually
come up...
Yes, that's the Beatles for you. If only we could come up with a succinct way to refer to the world's angriest boy in the world, other than just the world's angriest boy, but whatever.
I'm sure we could think of one way if we wanted to go political.
Yeah, but yes, we could, and I got a weird feeling, no matter what we do, at some point a political comment's going to be made here. I actually had one in my mind when I started, and I actually stopped myself. I'm going to censor myself. We don't want that to really be pervasive in our podcasting necessarily. Back to chapter 4, which I said I was going to be quick with. He also says something else, which we find out more about in the following chapter, when he says to David that he had a similar malady. I think we know by chapter 5, when Melanie tells us that Oliver had abilities similar to David's, and when she talks about what happened to him. I don't know if I would call it an Easter egg, just kind of an interesting kind of similarity in objects in the episode. If you look closely, you'll see that David's ex-girlfriend, Philly, her earrings look almost exactly like the ladder that leads to the Oliver's little ice cube palace. It's those little circles.
Cool design too.
Yeah, the set design and props and everything on this show is, A1, really nicely done.
Well, maybe they're trying to do some kind of like DNA theme or something with that, which kind of ties into mutation.
That actually makes a lot of sense. It does in some ways resemble a DNA chain. I hadn't thought of that. Good one. Nice. I feel like we should have mentioned last week, even though I think anyone who's really been paying attention to the show or reading articles maybe knows this, but who cares? I think it's really interesting that when they cast Aubrey Plaza, the whole point of when they cast her for a part that was originally supposed to be an older male, to the point where she even questioned, why would you cast me for this part? So that makes it really interesting that someone perhaps even made a decision after the fact, or just didn't clue her in from the get-go, that older male is actually going to be the whole Lenny Benny kind of situation. The fact that when she read a script, it was supposed to have been an older male to begin with is kind of an interesting little piece of trivia, if nothing else.
Yeah. Either way, whoever decided to cast her instead of an old dude, really good decision, guys.
Oh, yeah. I believe we will be talking about Ms. Plaza and her performance in Chapter 5, Something Fierce. It's something to behold. Mm-hmm. I'm almost near the end of Chapter 4 now. I noticed like a little interesting thing. Like in the lighthouse on the dock, on the front door interior, there is something that looks kind of like an octopus on the door. It almost had a very Hydra symbol look to it. It's just very noticeable in the background the entire time, so I couldn't help but notice that. I think I'd also speculated or wondered about the deal with the eye and whether bullets can affect him or not by the way he walks around. The fact that there's that moment in this episode where Tanami keeps shooting at him and ends up just looking at his gun, realizing it had no effect, I think that's the point where you realize that I don't even think bullets can reach the eye. I mean, they're not bouncing off him, but I don't know if they just die in mid-flight or they go in other directions or what, but they clearly somehow bullets do not affect him to the point where other characters are wondering what the hell's going on here. And finally, when I was watching closely, I realized that Lenny becomes the, what we were just calling, the Shadow King a little bit earlier on in the episode, slightly earlier on. That moment when she's egging on David, kind of to bring about the rage inside him, you see kind of a weird flash. It's one of the more subliminal flashes on the show, because usually the flashes last a little bit longer, so they really wouldn't be considered subliminal. But here it's really fast, where you see, I think you see those devil's eyes again. They already kind of, that's a big hint of the moment we're going to see at the very end of the episode, where, you know, it's that creepy as F-U-C-K moment when she's leering over David's shoulder with the creepy hand on one side and so on. Okay, that's really all I had left to talk about with Chapter 4. So I'm thinking maybe now we should dive into Chapter 5. Now, let's start off with a little question here, just for clarity's sake. Is Melanie a telepath? Because we can recall her trying to guide David on how to tune out those voices back in Chapter 2, and sprinkled throughout this episode are moments of communication between David and Melanie that are clearly words that are not spoken out loud. So, it's weird to begin a recap with a question, but I'm just wondering, do you think that's what they're telling us here? Because I feel like that's what they're saying.
Yeah, that must be what they're doing there. Yes. So I mean, I guess we kind of thought she was a Professor X stand-in for this show and the way they kind of got it set up. But I guess some have confirmed that now by having her have that kind of ability.
Yeah, I think you're right, and totally a Professor X stand-in just based on just having that kind of ability makes perfect sense. Now, however, back to the storytelling here. David does use his mouth to tell her that he's actually met her husband, refers to him as that beat poet who lives in a floating ice cube. But speaking of communicating in a different way, David has apparently come up with an entirely different place of existence, or plane of existence, I should say, or consciousness that he can bring Sid to. A place where he can literally be the magic man in her life, where they can actually touch, even if it is all an illusion. It's presented like it's a drug trip, giving them a chance of intimacy and sheer bliss, even if no one notices that bowl of bug-infested fruit, which I think is an indicator that even here, David cannot block out the evil that seems to hound him no matter where he goes, be it memories, dreams, or astral planes. I think we're going to have some questions about David even in the early goings here, but maybe we might save those for post-recap to not laden the recap with too many questions here. It does start to become more and more clear that this is not the same David that we have seen in the previous four chapters. At first he simply seems more sure of himself, more confident, but what initially seems almost impish starts to become more insidious as the episode wears on. Even as he talks about meeting Melanie's husband in that astral plane, the way he just keeps calling him the diver already shows a certain lack of empathy. But more facts are dug up here, because that's when we learn that Oliver has been in that, let's say, that condition for the last 21 years. And in fact, he had powers and abilities similar to David, but he succumbed to the lures and temptations of using them, which it sounds like ended up distancing himself even further and further from others and perhaps reality itself. But, as a clearly unsympathetic David points out, Oliver makes his own reality now, which is also where David seems to be hurtling towards himself. Now, I should mention that in the midst of all this, Carrie and Carrie Loudermilk, some really nice scenes between them, morph back into one person. Clearly the surgery was successful, and she does survive being shot by the eye. But back to David, who is taking full ass-bearing advantage of being able to touch Sid in that special place. I mean, the illusion he created, though I guess Sid's special places as well. Anyway, they're both in full cheeky mode here, so to speak. But David's determined to rescue his sister the next day. He's very matter-of-fact about it. You know, kick some ass, save the girl, get a snack. But his determination seems more glib. I mean, even his response to Sid saying they'll kill us is a dismissive, they'll try. So for the moment, it was as if David had bought into the hype of him being the most powerful mutant in the world, speaking in very nearly omniscient terms. It's a little strange that Sid's not quite bothered by all this, at least not yet. We do find out a little bit about her past, how she technically experienced sex before with one of her mother's old boyfriends, doing a little body switching with her mom, apparently. And switching back came during, sounds like, mid-penetration. It's one of those stories that becomes more and more disturbing the more you let yourself think about it, quite frankly.
Yep.
But it leads her to say something that was quite profound for this episode or this series overall. Who teaches us to be normal when you're one of a kind? She does follow that with words that will be repeated later in our heads as well. Promise me if you get lost, we'll get lost together. But afterwards, as we move out of the blue-tinted lighting of the bedroom, we are drawn into that weird red-lit bathroom, where that's where Lenny is, egging David on to go rescue his sister without any of the Summerlin mutants to assist. So later, when Sid awakens in the dream room to find David is gone, well, Melanie's worried, and Tanami, you know, if I can drop a curse that just really feels appropriate right now, he just don't give a fuck. He's not exactly David's biggest fan, because he believes they're spending too much time and resources on one selfish jerk while they're actually trying to fight a war. But after Sid makes it very clear that unlike Melanie, she's not treating David, this is the man that she loves, and that takes priority for her over any war as well, four of them take off for the Division 3 lair. You've got Melanie, Sid, Tanami, and the character, I actually had to look up what his name was, Rudy, who was that telekinetic mutant we saw flicking people away with a wave of his hand back in the rescue in the pilot episode. Oh, I don't know if you were aware of this, a little Fargo casting alert for us once again. The guy who plays Rudy, he's played by the actor Brad Mann, who was one of the Kitchen Brothers back in season 2 of Fargo.
Sweet.
I think I didn't recognize him because he didn't have any facial hair.
Yeah.
At the Division 3 headquarters, they find the aftermath of what looks like pretty much the most twisted and creepy war ever. Bodies of soldiers are everywhere, many in mid-phase through the floors and the walls. Now, the first person they actually do find alive is Dr. Kissinger, who is still trapped in his cell. But he's a little creepier than we've seen him before, which may be why they just leave him there. The foursome then splits into duos, and Melanie and Rudy find videos of what has happened. And that's when we see the cavalier, almost playful way David slaughters everyone in his path. But one of these videos, and we don't know if it was set up as some sort of X-ray or infrared or what sort of visual frequency they were using, finally it makes it clear to anyone who hasn't already caught on that this is no longer David. It's that devil. It's that Shadow King we were talking about. That's what's sauntering around the corridors, killing everyone. So the evil in David's mind hasn't merely taken over. He's actually manifest, as if wearing David was like wearing a mask, and now others can see him as well. Now, back at Summerland, one can say Loudermilk is talking to himself when in fact he's talking to his sister, who clearly wants in on the action that's taking place at Division 3. But Loudermilk is really busy watching videos of his own, videos of when David was in the MRI scanner. And at this point, he actually sees flashes of both the Shadow King and David as a child. You start to see that maybe these are more than just sides of David, but they're distinctly different personalities housed within him. You know, maybe that supposed schizophrenic diagnosis wasn't quite as far off as some may have believed. Now, back at Division 3, the team does find Brubaker, or I think what's left of him. I got the impression that part of him might have been left in mid-phase with the floor. I wasn't really sure.
Yeah, he was pretty fucked up there.
But, you know, what I surmise what must have been his dying words after bemoaning how wrong they were about David, he does say, "It wears a human face." But now we all know what that means. But we get a much more detailed explanation from Loudermilk when he actually contacts the team. And it's a very cool effect of how he speaks to them. I like that they did something very different than what you would have expected there. He has determined that there is indeed a creature, a parasite, that has been feeding off of David probably for the past 30 years. This creature, this thing, that's what's been responsible for the distortion and rewriting of David's memories, and in some ways of reality itself. That is the Shadow King. So we get a brief segue out of this horrific reality to the supposed safe place David had created. Although now, it becomes less apparent whether David was the one who created that place or not, which is something I think we'll be discussing a little bit later, because there's some really disturbing ramifications if you start thinking about that. But here we find David is, I guess you could say, wistfully picking away at a banjo while softly singing The Rainbow Connection. Sid sees both King the dog as well as that world's angriest boy hanging out in the red bathroom. At this point, it's clear that all of these things, the dog, the world's angriest boy, and most importantly, and creepily, quite frankly, Lenny, they are all versions of that same evil that's been plaguing David since his childhood. Which means that Lenny really is the Shadow King, or should we say Queen, whenever she's on screen. Now, Sid does figure out that David has taken his sister back to their childhood home through a handy-dandy placed telescope that's there. So then the quartet set off to find him there, while being followed by the Eye, who apparently was unscathed in David's decimation of Division 3. Now, at their old house, Amy soon realizes that she's on the receiving end of yet another creepy style of interrogation, because David insists that she has a secret. And even Lenny then appears to frighten the holy Jesus right out of Amy, but she does eventually confess that David, in fact, was adopted. But she doesn't know who his parents actually are. This is where we pause for comic book geeks like us to loudly cough, Professor X, Professor X. And if things weren't already weird and disturbing enough in general on this show, when the Summerland team arrives at the home outside, suddenly, the sound is gone. Nope, there was nothing wrong with your TV. There was just no sound. At least until inside the house when Sid is briefly startled by the world's angriest boy running past her, and then we do get some mild music playing in the background on the soundtrack. But people still cannot make sounds themselves. Which really makes it perfect timing for Carrie Loudermilk to appear, because anyone who knows about Bill Irwin's career will know or remember that he was essentially a professional mime. So it's an all-too-brief moment of levity we get when he actually attempts to use charades to communicate with Melanie. Because he's actually designed a device to put on David that should do something to disrupt that devil within. I'm not really clear if it would literally split them apart or not, but when Carrie does finally split apart, he allows his sister to have a bat that looks more deadly than that thing that Negan's carrying to join the party here. At this point, we're building to a really stunning and frightening conclusion with a succession of heart-stopping scenes, such as when they all converge in one room of the house. Rudy, who we see seconds earlier, is now, in fact, the Eye. I'm not really sure if the Eye just got the drop on him off-screen or what here. He tries to shoot David, and that's when David suddenly whisks Sydney away somewhere else. But the problem is that Lenny is there, and she's in full-blown, scary-ass, monstrous mode here. You know, she creepily says, this isn't the talking place, this is the listening place. And after she's flung up against the wall, all Sid can do is listen and watch as Lenny, who really comes off like a literal parasite here, straddles the semi-conscious David. And the look and sound of Lenny kissing David goes beyond animalistic. It almost sounds as if he's being fed upon. And in a snap, David and Sid are in their special place. Which really is less special and more horrifying the more we start to think about this. And all the paralyzed David can do or say is, I can't stop her. And then the devil itself enters in what might be the scariest moment in the series so far, when the Shadow King, fully manifest, is stalking Sid around the room, all the way to the bed. And then they're in a therapy session together, all of them. The session is being led by Lenny. Perhaps this is the talking place. And in this bizarre fashion, the episode ends with Sid saying, let's talk. So, I feel like I think this every week, but that was about as holy crap an episode as I think we've gotten on this show.
Yeah, but I don't know how they managed to keep ramping it up like this, but, you know, I guess maybe they're going to continue to do that for the rest of the season. And with only an 8-episode season, I believe. I guess that if they've done it this far, maybe they can keep it up. But damn.
Yeah, it's just when you're starting to try to get your footing with the show, and you're figuring, you think, oh, I'm figuring this out now. I'm understanding this, and then they take just one more turn, like, wait, what? You know. You know, I think I said, might have been in last week's podcast, and I might have just said it kind of casually myself, that in some ways David is becoming the villain of his own story. And, oh, by the way, you wouldn't realize this, but that's actually a wink to people who are fans of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. She sings a song like that. But back to this episode, I felt like that's almost the story of this entire episode, about David becoming the villain. So here's one really big question about the episode. Do you think we see the real David at all in this episode? Is the Shadow King in charge from the get-go? Or do you think it's sort of he's there and then he begins to take over more and more as the episode progresses?
The impression that the only anything even close to the normal version of David was probably the one playing the banjo. But for the rest of the part, I mean, I'm pretty sure that the last few seconds of chapter 4 with Lenny draping herself over him like that pretty much signaled, like, you know, the whole rest of the episode, the next episode is going to be, you know, creepy, crazy, terrifying, and, you know, this isn't going to be normal David.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out if, because is it, like, earlier in the episode when the way he speaks to Melanie at certain times, I'm trying to determine, is he just being influenced at that point? Or is he the creature wearing David as a mask at that point? Because that is what happens later on. Like, when he's killing everyone at Division 3, that's the creature, you know, basically, quote-unquote, dressed as David. And if you think about a lot of the things David does and says throughout this episode, more often than not, I don't think it's David. That's probably why everyone's noticing a change in him. But I think what I wonder about is it David who created that special place for him and Sid to finally be together? And is that just purely David in those moments? Or isn't it? Because if it's not, that's really, really scary, set and sad, or whatever. I'm not sure, because part of me wants to say it's David's under the influence, and it's when he goes into the red room, the bathroom, where I think the quote-unquote the devil takes over. Because if the devil had already taken over, then why would he be trying to convince himself in the bathroom? That wouldn't make any sense.
That makes sense.
So I'm thinking he's under the influence. That's why he's speaking, you know, in a somewhat overconfident way, whatever, because it's almost like the devil's on his shoulder, which is literally what we see at the end of chapter 4, of course, that you're referring to. But I think once he has that experience with Lenny and whatever let's call it the Red Room, I think that's when the change really happens, when he kind of takes over. Because not just of the way he murders everyone at Division 3, but even the way he's acting and treating his sister seems to be just far more, I've used this word way too many times on our podcast, but I don't care, far more malevolent than we would have ever expected to see from David. So I'm curious if either the Rainbow Connection moment, if what you say, if that's supposed to be what that's supposed to be, whether it's David kind of peeking out. It could be. I could see that. That could. I mean, if you think about it, you could look at that a couple different ways. I mean, that's a song a lot of kids knew about when they saw the Muppet movie, or it's a song that kids learned. If I'm not mistaken, I don't have the lyrics in front of me. Isn't that a song really about, you know, is it like about coping with being different, or how everyone shares a certain similarity or something? I can't really remember. I don't have the lyrics in front of me.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly how it is, but when I was listening to the lyrics, they definitely were applicable to the show. So another nice music selection by them.
Yeah, it's always interesting when you listen to certain children's songs, and then when they use in an adult context, how they take on such a much more different and darker meaning. Whether it be here with the Rainbow Connection, or even, you know, like that song from Pinocchio, Got No Strings on Me, which, you know, like that Avengers movie used really well or something. Just to keep it in the Marvel frame of mind, just to appeal to those people. So yeah, it doesn't really make those early scenes of intimacy with Sid maybe seem a bit more disturbing than maybe they should be. So I'm almost hoping for Sid's sake that that was David, you
Right.
know, because you know she's had a hard enough time. We had mentioned back when we were talking about chapter three that that was when they really started to dip into the horror territory. I think this episode more than any other is full blown horror. I think they just went for it in this episode. There was a lot of this scary, weird stuff throughout this episode, especially in the last half of it.
Yeah, I mean, as the in the beginning parts of the episode, like if I had to pick a, and actually this is like going through my mind while I was watching it, but just like I just felt unsettled. I mean, it just felt like, you know, everything was just a little off balance and stuff, and it just grew and grew as I watched the episode, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it, you know, and, you know, at the beginning of it, but it definitely just felt like that, just so unsettled the entire, you know, the entire time I was watching it right from the beginning. Just,
Yep.
I suppose, you know, combination of seeing how assertive David was being and how just unnatural feeling that, you know, if that provokes from what we've seen so far, and it just kept building and building, and then every little, like, you know, stylistic choice they ended up choosing, you know, on a technical level, just ended up being, you know, just magnifying it. I mean, they're just knocking this one out of the park.
Yeah, you are 100% right. I had the exact same feeling, and I remember thinking, in previous episodes, we tend to get disconcerted or thrown because of things like, you know, the use of montages or the fact that they have tend to adopt a non-linear way of storytelling here, or and they throw in some like really weird stuff. Here in this episode, we are constantly off balance, and I think a lot of it we have. I think we got to give them credit. It's not just the, and the writers as well, of course, but Dan Stevens' performance is so different, and it's not just simply that he's more confident, you know, but there seems to be something just, you know, creeping at the edges of his performance from the get-go, just from his conversations with Melanie, which are far different than anything we've seen before. It is sort of like he's playing the part like he's someone who's possessed, and he's trying to, you know, and whether he's trying to control it or not. But it makes for a lot of unsettling moments throughout the episode because we're never really sure what's going on. Because I don't know if we thought, I don't know if anyone thought from the get-go, oh, he's the devil now. But we kept going, there's something weird here. There's something, this isn't the David that we're familiar with, and I don't know how to feel about that. Because he's not, as it goes on, except for maybe the moment, some of the earlier moments with Sid, he's not terribly likable. And I don't think we would have said that in the first four episodes. I think we were all rooting for David to a certain degree. And here he is, before we realize what he's actually is, he's like, I don't know if, how much I like David right now. And
I think being very, very arrogant and.
yes, extremely so. Just quick sidetrack for something that just caught my ear, and I really wanted to give them a shout out or applause for it again. We talk about how the great use of visuals as well as audio on the show and music. I really love the use of a Radiohead song in this episode. There's something about the song that they chose that there's a certain sort of melancholy and building menace of that song that works really well with this episode. I think it happens specifically when they the four mutants show up at the Division 3 massacre. I think that's when we hear that song playing. So
Yeah.
it's really it. There's nothing surprising about a Noah Hawley television series using music well. I mean, it's one of the things we love about Fargo. They're doing it well here too. I mean, the use of audio throughout this episode is extremely significant. I mean, that whole silent sequence.
Oof. Yeah.
You wouldn't be familiar with this because you're not a fan of the show, but I suspect many of our listeners are familiar with it. It was very reminiscent of probably the most one of the most famous episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. There's an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer that's called Hush, where for most of the episode there is no audio because they've all essentially lost the ability to make sound or noise. You know, hence the title Hush. It's extremely memorable episode. So when they started doing that here, I was like, oh, they're doing Hush on us. And the fact that they even played a little, they even were able to find a little bit of humor in it, which they did when Bill Irwin shows up, was also reminiscent of the Buffy episode where there is a few moments of unexpected humor when someone's trying to, specifically when someone's trying to get across that they want to stake a vampire or a creature, and it looks like they're making a masturbation motion or something. I would just say watch that episode if you've never watched the show before, and that one will make you want to watch the show entirely. But back to this show. Oh, it's also like the 20th or 25th anniversary of Buffy right now, so it's really been in my head this week, I think. So back to Division 3. Were you wondering at all how the Eye survived?
I didn't give it a lot of thought. I just thought it was interesting that he was there, and I was more like feeling the menace of the fact that he was, you know, following closely behind them rather than wondering about his point of view during that whole massacre.
Yeah, I mean, I will confess, I didn't think about it during the course of the episode. It's one of those post-episode thoughts I had, because I was just remember thinking with that character. Did he just stay out of sight during the whole thing? No pun intended for his weird eye thing. Because it sounds, I don't think he actually encountered David. Again, I am more and more intrigued by this character, and I really want to get a handle on what his abilities are. And I'm hoping, I know we got a little teensy tiny bit of exposition about him in a previous episode. I kind of hope we get more in another episode. He's a character I really want to know the origin of. I really want to know more about him.
That'd be cool just to see how, you know, I mean, we, like you said, we got some information about him before, but I'm interested to see, like, how exactly he ties into all this and what the heck he's up to.
Because in some ways, he's one of the biggest question marks of the series. You know, everything from what can he do, you know, what's his real backstory, and the fact that he's clearly a powerful mutant himself, but he's working on the side of those who are either trying to, you know, enslave or use or kill mutants. So there's a lot I'm wondering about with that character.
And I kind of think he's kind of like, he's like the Hanzi of this series, where he just kind of like starts out float around in the background. We're like, okay, you know, that's an interesting looking guy. And then just as more and more time passes, he's just like more and more lethal and relevant.
You know what? He is the Hanzi of the series. You're absolutely right. For anyone who doesn't remember what we're talking about, Hanzi is a character in season 2 of Fargo. If you saw that season, you'll know who we're talking about. If you didn't see that season, go find that season and watch it. So let's talk a little bit about Aubrey Plaza here, finally. I don't like using this phrase because I feel it's really tired, and I have to roll my eyes whenever I hear other people saying it about any number of actors on other TV shows. It doesn't matter if you even love the actor. It's like, oh, shut up. But I'm looking, watching this, I'm like, wow, Aubrey Plaza is putting herself in line for like a supporting actress Emmy, because I didn't know she had this. I didn't know she could do this. She's amazing in this episode, man.
Yeah, this is definitely a show where we're seeing a lot of actors doing things like that we, you know, aren't used to seeing them do, and just like really, really magnificent ways. So I'm sure they'll just like pick somebody from some shitty show to win all these things, but hopefully these fuckers get a few nominations, because they're really several of them are just knocking it out of the park,
right,
day in, day out, and it's fun.
But someone like her, who's basically previous to this was a comedic actress that was really known for just her deadpan delivery and pretty much eye rolling all the time. This is about as scary as anything I've seen, period. Not just her. And I think it's really, there's something really funny about that, because it's so frightening. And this is on FX. And I'm going to say there are moments in this episode of Chapter 5 of Legion that I found to be more chilling or frightening than anything I've ever seen on American Horror Story.
Oh, by far, yeah.
You know, I was genuinely like freaked out or disturbed, whereas American Horror Story, I just kind of like, yeah, okay, whatever. So let's just get right to the ending, and what that could mean, that therapy session, because there are once again, and it seems like it's beyond Russian dolls at this point. It's every time you open something, it opens up yet a new world of maddening, I don't know, possibilities. And it really takes us back to the question that led this series off. Like I said at the beginning of the, back in the recap, I guess, or my questions. What is real? Because, like this therapy session, should we instantly think that this is yet another illusion? And if so, why would it follow the Shadow King just about to lay his creepy hands on Sid? Is this some sort of escape mechanism that David or Sid or someone else has used? They're really toying with us here, with the very idea that maybe no one's ever left Clockworks and they're all patients there. I mean, I personally, I'm reasonably sure that's not where they're going to go. Because that would just be like, no, that's beyond mindfuck at this point. That would just be a cheat. But the fact that that after five episodes, they are still able to taunt us with the idea that most of what we have seen may or may not even be real, more than what we had even imagined beforehand, it's a credit to the show that they can still pull that off, you know, five episodes in, I think.
And they can do it without feeling disrespectful or cheap either, which is something that we've, you know, seen on enough shows where they just, you know, pull some kind of thing out and then they're just like, oh, you know, this is pretty cool. I can't wait to, like, go on, like, Twitter or something and talk about how fucking great I am. And it just ends up being crap. But this is more just like, I mean, yeah, they're fucking with this, what they're doing it for, like, you know, because that just, like, is completely in line with, like, the level of the story. They're not just trying to be fucking cute.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I know, like, a more recent show that one could put this... it's not really a great comparison between them, but the comparison becomes more about one questioning things and mysteries, whatever. And that would be a show like Westworld, right? Yep. Which, and, you know, I liked Westworld. I didn't hate Westworld. No, I was critical of it more often than not, but I genuinely liked it. But I think what they're doing on this series has continued to engage me more, simply because, number one, character or characters, in this case, I really truly care about, which five episodes in Westworld was never the case. And this may sound a little goofy, because I'm just pulling this out of my ass right now, but I kind of look at this more as a piece of art, if that makes any sense. Or maybe I just appreciate the artistry more of what they're doing here. They're really doing so much more. Whereas, you know, Westworld, beautiful looking show. It's very, you know, set design, blah 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 blah. Although, you know, designing, you know, a Western town really isn't all that complicated, quite frankly. But but this show, I just feel takes it to a couple levels above that, even though, you know, they don't have even half the budget that Westworld has. Because Westworld has an astronomical budget, from what I understand.
Yeah. But, I think what's happening here is, I mean, we've been blessed with a lot of really good shows over the last several years, and now we're at the point where, you know, we just aren't happy with when we have a show that's just all style, no substance, you know, like True Detective and Westworld. Not that they're the first season of True Detective, because fuck the second one. But, you know, it's the kind of thing where, I mean, yeah, they're good, and yeah, there's whatever, but when you really, like, sit down to digest it, I mean, it's just like eating junk food. It's just, you know, crap. And then you have something like this, or The Leftovers, or whatever, where they can still have some style and make some interesting choices, but there's just, like, so much going on in so many different levels where, like, we actually are, like, you know, our enhanced appreciation of TV is, like, actually being satisfied instead of just, like, you know, distracted.
Yeah, it's absolutely about style and substance, and you're right. Too many instances, both film and television, where people get so taken away by the style, they fail to see that there isn't quite as much substance as they were led to believe. I think our feeling with this show so far is, no, it's still pretty substantial. And I will always say it's substantial because it's about both character and plot. It's not purely plot, the way some shows can be, or it's not purely mystery or whatever. You genuinely care about people, and they also give a decent amount of screen time and work to several characters as opposed to just, say, two, like in the first season of True Detective. Which, again, I really like the first season of True Detective in a lot of ways. I think the two lead performances are fantastic, and that's why that's really the reason you watch that season. But as far as other characters or the actual overall mystery, if you look back on it, it's fine, but that's not really what kept you watching the show. You watched it because of McConaughey and Harrelson. There wasn't really much else to watch on that show as far as, and that great opening song.
Right.
Okay, I think maybe now might be a good time to wrap things up, unless there's anything else you want to say about the episode.
Oh, I've got a few things to talk about.
Oh, excellent. Okay, go for it.
I really enjoyed the visual that they used for Loudermilk's like weird like holographic communicator thing that he was using there. It's just you know, I don't know where they got the idea to have such an odd design for that, but that was pretty cool.
I love that because there are so many ways they could have done that that would have felt, oh, we've seen that before. It might as well be Princess Leia telling us, you know, that Obi-Wan is our only hope or something. But they went full tilt. I love the craziness of it. I really enjoy, there's a lot. I mean, we don't really talk about the interesting use of photographic effects on the show, you know, but whether it be people being projected, whether it be in window frames or in the pupil of one's eye or how they shift from one scene to the next, but using very practical ways. But that hologram thing or whatever you want to call it that Loudermilk uses, that made me smile. I think, oh, that's really something creative. I really enjoy that.
Yeah, and speaking of the visual effects, I like the way that they kind of had when they split the two sections of the four team members and went to the facility to check stuff out when they split into two different teams, and they were kind of using the like the strobe-y flashy light stuff and burying the cuts between the two teams in those flashes. It was just such a sweet move there that they were doing. So I like the way they edited that and used that.
Yeah, I like that they take the time to even moments that, you know, may only be a few seconds on screen, which would just be your normal, oh, we're going to creep down this hallway. But they find just one way, another way, just to make it a little bit more visually interesting, a little bit more, and a little bit more artistic as well. And it's, you know, again, we talk about the use of visuals, the use of sound. The use of lighting and color is very, very pervasive on this show. I mean, it's you can't ignore it. And it's really adds something to all these scenes that just makes them stand out so much more than they normally would, you know, kind of like, like David's little escape hatch dreamland, whatever, you know, the fact that a lot of that is shot in that solid blue light. And then, so then we get the distinction with the red room. I mean, these are things that look gorgeous on film and yet didn't cost them $1 billion to put together.
Right. You know? Yeah. Hey, I've got a theory for the show now, but I think it's time to maybe I seem to be having, I don't know, at least some luck with predicting stuff this season of TV, at least on Arrow. But I guess this is the thing where if the listener doesn't want to get like theory spoiled, kind of like a lot of us were on the first season of Westworld, I guess now might be the time just to like, you know, kick this podcast to the curb, and thanks for listening. You yourself, are you fine with me plugging away? Or
go ahead, I don't mind.
Okay, all right. So, and this is something that just came to me at the beginning of our podcast here, while we were discussing the episode. But based on what we've been told so far and what we discussed today, I'd like to think that I think Oliver and Melanie are probably David's parents, just based on his power set and the fact that he's adopted and that kind of stuff, and the reaction that Jean Smart kind of had to being questioned about her motivations here. And I kind of got the impression that there's more than just like, you know, she wants to get her husband back type thing there. So that's what I'm going to guess. It kind of fits with like if she's a Professor X stand-in, and, you know, that would kind of also fit in a, you know, tied into the comics kind of way, if that's what they're doing on the show. So that's my theory.
That is such a great theory. I really like it. You know why I like it? It reminds me of a moment that happened earlier in the series. It was chapter 3, when we see Melanie by herself walking through David's childhood home.
Yeah.
It's the way she's looking around. The way she looks at what we assume are David's, I guess, adopted parents' house. She stops to give them a look. And then she continues. And then the fact that when she goes into his closet and takes out, you know, takes out that childhood book, which turns out to be the horrifying book, of course. If you look at those scenes and you apply your theory to them, it really makes those scenes take on a different type of significance. That,
yeah,
you know, she's look, you know, this is what she missed out on when she gave up her child, so to speak.
Yeah,
I really like that theory a lot. That's a good one. I really think that could be a possibility. I really like that theory. And especially because they mentioned Oliver having those abilities. So right. The whole genetic inherited thing, you know, I don't know how that really worked with mutants exactly. I guess it probably doesn't traditionally, but who cares?
Oliver definitely seems to have, you know, that same kind of like mental instability where, you know, he pretty much had to like wall himself off, presumably had to wall himself off to keep from like going completely like batshit insane. So that's why he's like literally chilling in an ice cube.
Yeah,
maybe.
Exactly. Wow. See what happens when you bring your A game, suddenly our podcast gets cool again. Awesome.
Yeah, as long as I'm not tranquilized by old medicine, sometimes I can get her done.
It's too bad that Skype threw a monkey wrench at us and broke our podcast in two while we were recording, so hopefully you'll be able to perform some surgery and knit two chunks together here.
Right, and I guess, yeah, one more thing. I was glad that when they went to the special place of David and Sid there, the last scene there, where I'm glad they didn't go like full rapey on it. I mean, I'm pretty sure it wasn't a Noah Hawley last year where he said like, you know, I'm just like, or I don't know who it was that said that. Maybe it was Brian Fuller.
It was Brian Fuller. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but anyway, it just kind of, it was just nice that they didn't have to like, you know, go, they just make it all about that. So, you know, Noah, I have respect for Noah Hawley, so I wouldn't expect him to do that anyway, but it was just kind of nice that they just, you know, they could have her fall into the bed, but the thing was just like creepy, terrifying. You didn't have to go like, oh, you know.
Yeah.
It's all about that.
I honestly didn't even think about that even being what was about to happen there. Although I was thinking if Dave, that is why I kept hoping, I hope David was David earlier and he wasn't in possession mode, because then that's sort of kind of is disturbing. Mm-hmm. But we're going to hope that wasn't the case. Oh, and I know I say it every week, but I'll just, my final thought is I deeply adore Sid. I really like if I knew her and, you know, I could hang out with her, I just couldn't touch her and you know, but we could be boyfriend and girlfriend, I would find a way to live with that. I'd pull a David there. In which case,
yeah, it gives me hope for my own future, because, I mean, she's from the Twin Cities area, which is only like an hour and a half from me. So I'm just like, oh, maybe there are like really like super adorable, like, you know, charismatic human females in my general vicinity. So.
One more little thing. How cool was it, just to make sure that people on both sides of the gender spectrum could enjoy it, that both actors had to expose their ass? So you didn't just get the girl doing it, or just didn't get the guy doing it. You got an equal amount of ass there. I know why I was happy, but I'm sure there were a lot of Downton Abbey fans out there that were probably happy to see Dan Stevens tush. So
yeah,
I can't believe I'm ending the podcast on an ass note, but that's where I think we need to end it here. So if you enjoyed this podcast, and I'm sure you did, you'll probably enjoy our Facebook page as well. That's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Type that in, like the page, and you can join the conversation about shows like Legion and several others. You can also follow us on iTunes. Type in Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and review us there. You can also follow us on the Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. It's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. And as I am doing in every podcast now, I want to thank anyone who's taken the time to not just rate and review us, but also pass our podcast along, whether it be by retweets or Facebook or whatever. It doesn't happen too much, but when it does happen, it's greatly appreciated. So that was it. That was our 165th episode about the fifth chapter of Legion. 165 sounds like we've been doing this for years and years and years, and it's only been, what, three?
Yeah, I had a thing on Facebook show up today saying that, like, it reminded me that we released episode 28, one of the Better Call Saul ones, like, must have been 2 years ago, or maybe three, I don't fucking know anymore, but I'm just like, whoa, 28, whoa, that's a lot of shit's happened between now and then,
yeah,
most of it podcasting.
I think we're coming up on our third anniversary in April. I think our first podcast was dropped in April when Mad Men began, so.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Not that there's anything really significant about 3 years, but. Who knows if we'll make it to a fourth? We'll see. Anyway, yeah. With that, I'm going to say, can't say good night, so I guess I'm going to say good morning, Dan.
Yeah, good morning, Scott.
And goodbye.